I have a slideshow on my website called The Evolution of Money, and I'm just going to give you the overview. Historically, money was commodities. Various things have served as money. Tobacco, hides, gold and silver are the best known. And when people wanted to buy something, actually they just turned over a piece of gold or a piece of silver. But that's basically still a barter transaction. It's one commodity for another. Then later on, the advantages of symbolic money became apparent. So banks began to issue paper currency that were redeemable for commodity money. So you could take your bank note and pass it across the counter and say, give me the gold. And then, when gold and silver weren't sufficient to provide the exchange media needed by developing economies, bankers invented credit money. Credit money is perfectly legitimate money if it's properly issued. It's really something that's backed up by physical assets. But instead of gold and silver on deposit, credit money would be backed up by, say, a mortgage note or a bill of sale on inventory. But the thing is, credit money is usually based on long-term assets. There's a monetary doctrine called the real bills doctrine. If I sell you some merchandise, I send you an invoice and I ship the goods, but you have a certain length of time to pay me. So there might be 30 days or 60 days elapsed before you receive the goods and before you have to make payment. So that's a real bill. When I send you an invoice, that's called a real bill. And one of the primary sources of credit money in the early days of banking was when banks would take those bills and create money on the basis of those bills. Now, what are the sources of credit for business? Well, the first thing we think about, of course, is banks. You go to the bank and you get a loan. But that's not the only source of credit. You can also get credit from your customers. Gift cards are becoming more and more popular. I usually get a couple of them at Christmas time. My kids know that I like books, so they send me a gift card from Barnes & Noble or Borders. Basically, what that amounts to is pre-sold goods. It's prepayment for merchandise that hasn't been delivered yet. Still another source of credit for a business is suppliers and employees. So suppliers might be paid with vouchers or merchandise certificates or complementary currencies. Likewise, you might pay your employees partly in merchandise certificates or vouchers. This was quite common in mining towns in the old days. Of course, it led to a lot of abuse sometimes, with the company store being the only place where you could spend the vouchers. And quite often, prices were elevated above what they normally would have been. But this can be a legitimate source of credit for a business if it's done correctly with vouchers or direct credit clearing, which we'll get into in a minute. I'm talking these days about the credit commons. It's one aspect of the commons that has been forgotten and abused. Privatization of the commons has been rampant in all aspects, and I think what we need to do is to begin to restore the commons, including the credit commons. The organization and allocation of credit is a fundamental feature of civilized society. And so it's crucial how we manage to do that. Now, currently, we allow the banking system, and banking is actually mainly a cartel. We allow the banking system to control the credit commons and to control access to credit. So the only way that we can get access to the credit commons now is by going through a bank And banks allocate credit by making what they call loans. So either an individual or the government or business would have to go through a bank to access the credit commons. Access to credit being controlled by the banking system means that banks get to decide who gets credit and on what terms. Of course, banks collect interest whenever they make a loan. So credit becomes expensive. Favored clients get credit on easy terms, while others go begging. That's the whole basis for the micro-lending movement. Many people were denied access to credit until Muhammad Yunus started the Grameen Bank, and that was replicated by FINCA and many other organizations. So micro-lending is big business now, but it still involves lending at interest. National governments especially have extraordinary access to credit because they have sort of a collusive arrangement with the banking system that allows the governments to spend as much as they want without regard to tax revenues. How is it that the United States government can run budget deficits of $400 billion, $500 billion a year, year after year after year? It's because they have special access to the credit commons through the banking system. So they can borrow as much as they want, mainly to fight wars, and never have to repay it. When was the last time the U.S. government paid anything back on national debt? Yeah, there were a couple modest surpluses during the Clinton administration. Didn't last long. So the point is that direct access to credit is possible and desirable, and it's crucial to our efforts at relocalization. It's our collective credit that supports the monetary system, and we have the power to use our credit as we wish. We're free to decide who we will trust, and we can allocate credit directly to one another. Now, how are we going to do this? You know, this sounds complicated. Well, it really isn't that complicated, and I'll explain. Let me compare the conventional payment process using bank credit with an alternative. Let's suppose we have these four companies. Let's suppose that Alpha owes Bravo $100. Bravo owes Charlie $100. Charlie owes Delta $100. Delta owes Alpha $100. How do these debts get discharged? Well, typically, at least one of these companies has to go to a bank and borrow some money into circulation. So let's say it's Alpha that goes and borrows $100 from the bank. Then it pays Bravo. Now Bravo has $100. It can pay what it owes to Charlie. And Charlie can now pay what it owes to Delta, and Delta can pay what it owes to Alpha. Now everybody's been paid except the bank, but Alpha now has the $100 back, so it can repay what it owes to the bank. However, there's also interest due on that loan. Now, one of the destabilizing and dysfunctional aspects of the dominant money and banking system is the fact that when the bank makes a loan, it creates the principal, but it doesn't create the money to pay the interest. So you have this exponential growth in debt with the passage of time. That's what the compound interest formula is. It's exponential. It's that upward sloping curve that accelerates in its growth. And that's what's destroying the planet. That's what's destroying the social fabric in the world, and that's what's driving us to extinction if we continue. What's the alternative? Well, here we have the same four companies, the same four debts. Alpha owes 100 to Bravo, Bravo owes 100 to Charlie, Charlie owes 100 to Delta, and Delta owes 100 to Alpha. Well, suppose Bravo is willing to accept Alpha's IOU. That is, give Alpha credit. So it accepts Alpha's IOU as payment, and let's suppose Charlie is willing to accept that IOU in turn, as payment from Bravo, and Delta is willing to accept it in payment from Charlie. And finally, Delta pays Alpha the $100 that it owes Alpha. So Alpha started this process by issuing an IOU, and it ended the process by redeeming its own IOU. So again, everybody's been paid using the internal credit of Alpha. All the debts have been paid and no interest was required. So this is the basic idea behind mutual credit clearing. Now, in this particular example, we're talking about the credit of only one company, Alpha. But in a well-organized mutual credit system, we're talking about the collective credit of all the members. And we'll get to that in a minute. So to explain further, what is a mutual credit clearing exchange? It's an association of buyers and sellers that provides for the direct settlement of bills due to one another without the use of conventional money or banks. This reduces or diminishes the need for conventional money as an intermediary payment medium. So this association of traders can agree to offset purchases against sales among one another. In effect, goods and services pay for other goods and services. That's true no matter what. We only use money as an intermediary device to facilitate this process. And we're so accustomed to doing that, we never think that there might be another possibility. So another way to describe this is that accounts receivable are used to offset accounts payable. Every business has accounts receivable and accounts payable. An account receivable results when you ship goods to a customer and you give them an invoice and you wait for payment. An account payable is when you receive goods from a supplier and they wait for you to pay them. And usually there's some time period, depending on the line of business. It might be 30 days or 60 days or in some cases even 90 days before you have to settle your bill. So that time span and that giving of credit to one another provides the space for everything to work out. So goods and services pay for other goods and services. Money is an intermediary device. When you sell something in a credit clearing system, your account gets credited. That means increased. When you buy something, your account gets debited, decreases. So you have an account balance. Sometimes your balance is positive. You've sold more than you've bought. Sometimes your account balance is negative when you've bought more than you've sold. But these are temporary conditions. In the long run, your account balance is going to fluctuate around zero. Now, people often ask, well, what happens at the end of the cycle, at the end of the month, or at the end of the two-month period if there are residual balances? Some people are going to be in the negative, some are going to be in the positive. Well, if it really bothers you to have that situation, you can settle up. It's like you do at the end of a poker game, you know. Those who have more chips than they started with get cash, and those who have fewer chips pay in cash. But the amount of cash needed to settle is very small in comparison to the total amount of business transacted. But ideally, in a mutual credit clearing system, we would carry those balances over indefinitely. Here's an example. Talking about community support dollars, suppose we have this mutual credit clearing system and we've issued 100,000 credits within the system. That means that the collective cash expenditures of the associated businesses are reduced by $100,000. And that $100,000 remains within the circle to be spent within the circle and not for imports from outside. Now, if the turnover of that credit is 10 times a year, that $100,000 in credit is going to finance the exchange of $1 million of local sales. And if the profit on those sales is only 20%, that means additional yearly profits of $200,000 for the associated members. Further, if the issuance of CSDs will enable some interest-bearing debt to be retired, It's $100,000 worth of working capital that you don't have to borrow from a bank. And if you're paying 10% interest on short-term debt to the bank, that means $10,000 of saved interest each year. So to sum up, every dollar's worth of community support dollar credits that are issued means one less dollar that needs to be borrowed, one less dollar that needs to be spent, and one less dollar that needs to be repaid at interest. Now, is this just a pipe dream? Not at all. We have precedents and we have examples, one of which is the Swiss Vierbank that was started in 1934 in the midst of the Great Depression. The Vierbank is a mutual credit clearing system operated for the benefit of the small and medium-sized businesses throughout Switzerland. Now, this credit clearing circle has thrived for more than 70 years. It has now 60,000 business members throughout Switzerland. It has 6 regional offices, and in 2004, it cleared the equivalent of $1.35 billion worth of credits. That's the amount of sales that went through this mutual credit clearing circle. Now, in 2005, I visited the Vierbank, and I also had the occasion to speak with a professor, Tobias Studer. And Tobias Studer is on their board of advisors, and he wrote a book about the history and the operations of the Vierbank. And your own Phil Beard translated that book from German into English, and it's a very important book to read. It's available on the web through lulu.com. You can download it for $3, is it? Or you can get a hard copy for something like $15. Now,
L-U-L-U,
yeah.
It's not... called Beer and the Swiss National Economy. Beer and the Swiss National Economy.
I will give you a reference website at the end of the presentation through which that is linked. You'll find it on my website. So this is one example of a successful mutual credit clearing operation. Unfortunately, it hasn't been replicated widely. The Swiss are very coy about this, and, I won't go into that.
Oh, that sounds interesting.
Maybe later in the Q&A. This is a graphical representation of a mutual credit clearing system. Let's suppose the oval defines the boundaries of our association, and the little smiley faces represent the businesses who are members of the association. Now, you note I have 2 different classes of membership. The greenies are members who can issue credit, and the others are non-issuing members. What I mean by that is an issuer is one that has a line of credit that is an overdraft privilege. That's a member that can buy before they sell. Their balance can go negative. They are the source of the credits that will circulate within the association. The non-issuing members must earn before they can spend. They must sell before they buy. So the issuing members begin this process by buying from other members. So the arrows represent the expenditure of credits. And it started with this issuing member buying something from that member and using credits to pay for it. So those credits will circulate internally pretty much indefinitely. Now, is this an elitist approach to exchange? Well, not really. This can benefit the entire community, but you have to determine who is qualified to issue credits that will circulate within the association and outside of the association. Here's our mutual credit clearing system again. Let's suppose that one of the members of the clearing association wants to buy something from a non-member, someone outside of the association but still in the community. Those non-member users will be represented by these gray smiley faces. They're not members, but they're in the community and they have goods and services to offer. Well, you can externalize the credit that exists in a mutual credit clearing association, either by printing notes to represent the credit or by using smart cards or stored value cards. It's easiest to think in terms of notes. So this process begins when this member bought something from this non-member, and this non-member agreed to accept the association credits as payment. And this is strictly voluntary. There's no legal tender laws supporting this currency. It has to stand on its own merits, and people can refuse it or they can discount it if they want. So note that those credits have to eventually come back inside the oval. They need to be redeemed by someone in the association because it's the collective credit of the association members that stands behind these currency notes. So let's review the advantages of this local circulation. Currency credits that are created in this way must return to the issuers for redemption. And we're not talking about redemption in gold or silver or even Federal Reserve notes. We're talking about redemption in valuable goods and services, which are the stock in trade of the members that issued the credits to begin with. So for this reason, the credits are captive within the local economy. They're not going to go very far for very long because they have to come back for redemption. And their recirculation within the local area provides a built-in buy local bias. If I have local currency credits in my hand instead of dollars, I'm going to favor the local merchants who accept those local credits. So they give local sources of supply a preference over external sources. Decentralized exchange and payment options, such as we've described, provide enhanced local autonomy. If we have our own medium of exchange, we're going to be less subject to the influence of the Federal Reserve, whether they decide to make money easy or tight, whether they decide to make interest rates high or low, whether the government decides to run a big deficit or a small one. It gives greater local economic health and security because now we have a more abundant supply of exchange media. You know, the supply of dollars is always scarce. It provides a counterweight against systematic monetary instability. It provides a recovery path in case of financial collapse. And more people are expressing concern about that because of the twin deficits, the budget deficit and the trade deficit. And it ultimately results in greater equity, social harmony, and local quality of life. Well, how do we go about implementing something like this? Well, you do it in stages. The first stage is to organize the Mutual Credit Clearing Circle, comprised of trusted business issuers. You want to get the most popular, most financially sound businesses in your community to be the initial issuing members. And if you can get the local government involved, that's a bonus. So you start with trusted issuers, and they can begin to trade among themselves using internal credits. Then they can collectively issue a currency that will circulate throughout the entire local economy. And people will be willing to accept that currency because they know they can take it back to the trusted issuers for valuable goods and services that they want and use every day. If you get the power company involved, for example, if you have a local power company, or if you have the local food co-op, or a restaurant, popular restaurant like this, try to get the most popular trusted businesses to be the anchor, the foundation businesses in the system. It's like when they develop a shopping mall. You know, they first start out by recruiting the anchor stores. the J.C. Penney's, the Robinson Mays, Dillard's, Home Depot, you know, the big ones that are going to by themselves attract customers to the plaza. So second stage is to accept to membership diverse other participants, but don't give them overdraft privileges to begin with. Require that they earn before they spend. Then in the third stage, you can invite non-member local merchants to be currency users. They would be the gray circles that we saw in the diagram. Invite them to accept the local currency. The advantage to them will be that they will attract more business to their stores compared to stores that don't accept the local currency. Because as the currency becomes widespread and dispersed throughout the community, those businesses that accept it in payment are going to attract more of the business. So now you've got everybody in the community, or almost everybody, using the currency. So when the credit clearing circle is functioning smoothly and the currency has been widely accepted, then you can ease the restrictions on membership and bring more and more people, more and more businesses into it. But whether you give overdraft privileges or not depends on the sales history and the credit worthiness of each new member. And people often ask, what do you use to determine the credit limits? Well, there's a good rule of thumb that has been developed over the past from experience, and it says that the amount of turnover credits, or the amount of short-term credits that we use as money, should not exceed 3 months' sales. So if a business has $50,000 sales a month, you could safely allow them to overdraw by $150,000. But I wouldn't go anywhere near that limit to begin with. I think to begin with, you could get by with maybe a third of that. Another point is that you have to operate this as a self-sustaining business. One of the problems with local currency systems and mutual credit systems that have been implemented in this country and in other countries is that they've been volunteer-based. People don't get paid for their work, so you end up with volunteer burnout. People get tired of doing the work. The system is not operated in a business-like fashion, and eventually it just falls apart. So this has to be operated according to sound business principles. You have to charge fees that are going to cover the costs. But, you know, the larger this exchange system becomes, the smaller those fees can be. You've got to reach critical mass where you can provide the service at a competitive fee. Businesses pay a transaction fee on credit card transactions. I think it's anywhere from 3 to 5% on average. Well, some people have estimated, and I tend to agree, that once we get a mutual credit clearing system of sufficient scale, we can operate it efficiently with transaction fees of less than 1%. And some of those expenses are cash expenses, so you also have to have some cash income. Some of the expenses can be paid using internal credits, like maybe the employees could take a portion of their salary in internal credits and a portion in conventional money. But all salaries need to be paid out of revenues generated from service fees, not from borrowing. This last point highlights one of the deficiencies in the commercial trade exchanges. You're probably familiar with BXI, Barter Card, ITEX, business-to-business trade exchanges that do things like this already. The commercial barter industry, and barter is a misnomer here, they're really credit clearing exchanges, has been around for more than 30 years, and there are many very successful companies that are providing this service for businesses to trade with one another. And they pay large fees for the service. But a lot of those systems give themselves extraordinary privilege to borrow on their own account. So they end up running up a big system debt, which eventually debases the value of the credits in their system. So they put themselves into competition with the members and create a conflict of interest. So system account deficits should be avoided or strictly limited. So basically, that's the presentation. Here are some resources that you can avail yourself of. The first is reinventingmoney.com. That's a website that I initiated about 4 years ago. It's recently been redesigned and reorganized, and you'll find links to lots of valuable information about this exchange process and about creating currency systems. I have a blog called Beyond Money that's on WordPress that provides more up-to-the-minute information about things that you might find useful, what I'm doing, where I'm going. The last two items are references to my books. This is the most recent one, which was published by Chelsea Green in 2001. This was the first one that I published back in 1990, called Money and Debt, A Solution to the Global Crisis. It's basically an analysis and critique of the dominant monetary system, with, in the latter part, some guidance as to how a better system might be created. New Money for Healthy Communities was in between those two, and it was basically an overview of alternative exchange systems. It's been pretty much superseded by the money book. I also want to call your attention to this book and this one. These are both by E.C. Riegel. I learned more from Riegel than from anybody else. He died in 1954, but he's tremendously insightful about how money works, what money is, and I highly recommend those to you.
That was author and alternative currency expert Tom Greco speaking earlier this year in Sebastopol, California. He has a website called Beyond Money, which can be found at beyondmoney.wordpress.com. We'll conclude the program with the next installment of For Giving, A Feminist Critique of Exchange by Genevieve Vaughn. One recurring theme in this work has been the consideration of language, both in the way it forms our social relationships through forming the way we think about things, as well as its origin as a domain of the gift of communication. Last week, we concluded Chapter 6, which Vaughn ended by talking about her experiments in child-rearing through consciously using language to form her daughter's social personality, something she concluded was not very effective as an isolated case. In her example, she decided not to teach her daughter the possessive pronouns, mine, yours, his, hers, so that instead of saying, "That's Daddy's," she would say, "Daddy uses that." The problem was that outside of a few cooperative friends, no one else was speaking that way. What struck me as I read that was that she would not have had this problem if she had been speaking a different language. In some languages, such as Diné, it is not possible to express ownership of a living creature, whether human or not, as if it were an object, nor of land. In English, we say, "my husband." Diné say, "the man for me." In English, we say, "my dog." Diné say, "the dog who works for me." Thus, we can see how the language which is passed on to us by our society forms our outlook toward things. You might be unsurprised to learn that the Diné are a matrilineal culture that frowns upon a person who devotes themselves to the accumulation of things instead of sharing them. The very opposite of greed is good. And lest you think that Europeans and their languages reflect only wall-to-wall greed and domination, the Irish language, the tongue of a once matrilineal culture, retains something of a different concept of possession. In English, we say, "I have a cup of coffee." In Gaelic, one says literally, "the cup of coffee is at me," which speaks to a relationship of location rather than ownership. Something to think about. as we begin Chapter 7, The Collective Source, in Forgiving, A Feminist Critique of Exchange by Genevieve Vaughan. Vaughan writes, "Through language, every individual weaves an answer to the deepest philosophical question of our time. What is the relation of the one to the very many? The relation of the individual to her culture, and from thence to the 5.5 billion other humans now living, is very different from her relation to her village or social group in centuries past. The media brings us images and information about billions of people we will never see or meet, who are just as human as we are. Similarly, astronomy has brought us a view of our one planet Earth in the midst of millions of galaxies and billions of other stars and all their possible planets. As our knowledge of humanity and the universe has increased, our dimensions as individuals relative to the whole have shrunk incredibly. Yet each of us remains in the foreground for herself and thus appears very large, because she occupies her own view. The answer to this question, from the point of view of the gift paradigm, goes something like this. Each human is a part of the collective, because his identity is formed by using the collective's material, cultural, and linguistic gifts, which are given to each of us by others, and are given by each of us to others. Our physical and psychological subjectivities are made of that matter, that matrix or mother, which we ourselves reform and become again for others. Each of us is a point or locus, a stitch in the fabric made by the transmission of innumerable gifts. In this fabric, the collective process relates things to words, words to words, things to things, and us to each other, and through the gifts at all the different levels. The reiteration of masculation at different scales has altered the configuration of this collective process, directing the flow towards a category of self-motivating dominant ones who attempt to expand their individual importance by establishing relations of control over the collective and its gifts. These ones are often served by other ones who access a relation to the many indirectly through their relation to the one who dominates the many. While it is conceivable that the expanded ones could give their gifts back to the many, this is not in accord with the gender mandate towards overtaking. Unfortunately, the relation of dominance by the one over the many appears to have a possible outcome in the destruction of the many by the one. Recently, the ability to cause nuclear devastation has made that power available, and some ones have played with it. We must reveal the illusory character of the motivation to dominate and expand and recreate ourselves through the giving and receiving process, finding a way to relate as nurturers, as ones among many and many among many. Environmental niches. An environmental niche is a gift for which receivers evolve. Creatures develop with needs that can receive that kind of nurturing. Language is a product and a byproduct of the life of past generations, which present generations and individuals can receive and use. It is a collectively created cultural environmental niche. We need to interact with each other in regard to things because they are valuable to us collectively and individually in various ways. And we have been able to use things collectively and individually in various ways to bring their value to fruition. Others in the society have contributed a lot of the value of things, but the same is true of the value of words. Usually, the how to use it side of our immediate environment, at least, has been given to us free, just left there for us to pick up or handed down to us by our mothers. This, as well as the knowledge of what would be appropriate for us to use, is transmitted to us by others in the society. But all of that, all of our material culture, happens to be there because others have been interacting with it through the centuries and mediating their interactions with language. Not only have women and things been left out of consideration, but the life processes of the multitudes of the past and present have often been ignored by philosophers who value words above things because they are viewing the world from a decontextualized, masculated point of view. The attitude of sexism is much broader than the issue of gender. It initiates denials and distortions of points of view which influence many other issues. It enters into the interactive dialectic between words and things, definer and defined, deeply altering the collective perspective and the world picture that is presented to its view. Exchange has mistaken some of the processes of language, and by transferring them onto the material plane, created a situation in which the gift is actually canceled by the requirement of an equivalent counter-gift. This artificial situation is created by reusing the part of the pattern where the word takes the place of a thing, making the gift of the thing unnecessary for the creation of the human relation at the moment. I do not need to give you this flower to create a human relation of communication with you at the moment. I can simply say the word flower. The word also serves as a sample equivalent. In the description of the concept process, we discussed how the sample thing is no longer necessary when the word takes its place as the equivalent for the category. On the material plane in exchange, when the counter gift is given, it also cancels the gift character of the first gift and expresses its value, representing it. This is particularly clear when money is the counter gift. Money takes the place of the product as the equivalent of other products, thus replacing and canceling that product as an equivalent. It measures and represents the value of the product in exchange as the substitute gift. Curiously, money, the arbiter of exchange, functions only by being given away. Money also cancels both the qualitative value and the gift value, the inference that the other person is valuable, replacing them with quantitative value and exchange value, so they are seen within the category of all the other products on the market. The nurturing human transaction of gift-giving is altered, and part of the concept process put in its place to mediate the mutually exclusive relation of private property. This material use of the concept and transposed linguistic process allows each exchanger in turn to act out the definition, to give and receive the substitute gift word, money. The exchangers can thus give without depriving themselves. They give value to things and their substitute, money, rather than to one another. Money is the means of communication by which the product is defined, and the buyer gives it to the seller, much as the definer gives the definition to a listener. The seller, in turn, has to give up the product. As it passes through the incarnated concept process, the product's gift value is canceled and transferred onto the money, which is exchanged for it, and which we therefore call the exchange value of the product. As the product becomes the property of the buyer, it exits from the market process and becomes a use value. When it cancels the attribution of value to the receiver, The process of exchange cancels the gift value of the product in a way that has not usually been recognized. The use value is, as it were, wiped clean of previous experiences. Having bought it and paid its price, we no longer think of where it came from. We usually pay no attention to whether the source of the product we are using is underpaid so-called third world workers, child labor, or U.S. union members. The product is ready for our use, but gratitude and recognition are not given to its makers, nor is the product received from its makers as a nurturing gift, transmitting value to its receivers by implication. Instead, recognition and gratitude are given to the one who made the money, or perhaps the buyer, the seller, or the market process itself. For this reason, I believe there is an invisible logical difference between use values which have passed through the process of exchange and use values which are made by people directly for others and which transmit gift value. The person who uses the use values, preparing and adapting them for the satisfaction of the needs of people in her family, does add gift value to them. But the gift value given to them by their makers has been canceled or diverted into others' profit by the exchange process. And I'm reading from Forgiving, A Feminist Critique of Exchange by Genevieve Vaughan. Starting with the world. In his analysis of money and commodities, products in exchange, Marx took commodities as his starting point. He believed that previous thinkers had been wrong to begin with money. A similar consideration can be made about the relation between words and the world. In formulating our question about that relation, we usually take words as our starting point, which sets us off on the wrong path to begin with. We need to start with the world, not with words. With material communication, not verbal communication. The answer in either case passes through the gift activity of human beings. However, by starting with words themselves, we cannot see the gift character of words or things. The gift character is also hidden because of the word's transparency. Because the word position is burdened by masculation, and because there is a motivation towards taking the place of in the definition, etc. Placed in an inferior, quote-unquote, gift-giving stance towards masculated men, the position of women is similar to the position of things in relation to words. Thus, it is easier for women to understand language, starting from the point of view of things, while men usually take the point of view of words. Of course, all humans are also things related to words. When we are being talked about, that person over there, the next one in line, Janie's friend. However, because the word has been incarnated in the male gender, women analogously take on the role of things in relation to that word. We have known what it is to be spoken about rather than to speak, to give way to the one who takes our place, stands for us, represents us in public, while we continue our gift-giving at home. But women actually put ourselves in relation, do the work of maintenance, caregiving and child-rearing, all the myriad tasks that women have had, continually giving gift values to others in many ways. Things do not do this in first person as we do. They do not put themselves into a relationship with people. What accounts for their active side? It is the activity and creative receptivity of the collective, beyond the focus of the individual, the background of the many, in which women have also been anonymously standing for centuries. Our unacknowledged giving providing for others directly and indirectly, is the process and result of an ongoing collective interactive dialectic with things. Not only do humans practice giving, but in the process, we leave a considerable amount of byproducts available for the taking. Sometimes it has seemed that women and other excluded people were only a few men's byproducts and like things, only had the value given by the collective, not value coming from themselves as givers in interaction. Things are also like women in that they give way to words, letting them take their place. The treatment of women as things which nurture and give way in a many-to-one relation to those men who take over and own or control them repeats the relation between things and words that has always been so hard for philosophers to understand. The male philosophers were starting from their own point of view, the point of view of the overtakers, the owners and controllers, the ones as opposed to the many's. Women, treated as things, can take the point of view of things, the many, those that give and give way. Someone might ask, do things really give and give way to words, like women give way to men? In the fabric of innumerable gifts that make up the process of the life of the collective, are things enlivened by our magic hands to become Pinocchios, obedient to their father's words at last? Or is it all a projection? Leaving aside Geppetto's words, witches and the blue fairy feel the life of inanimate things, perhaps because as women, we know we are like them under a spell of objectification. Anyway, our words are different, less empty than masculated men's, because we also speak things. And I'm reading from Forgiving, A Feminist Critique of Exchange by Genevieve Vaughn. Meaning, if we start with things instead of words, we can locate meaning in things in all their varieties of appearance and uses, with their relation to words as their relation to their substitute gift for human beings. Different kinds of things are related to a word. What we usually call different meanings of the word can also be similar to each other. For example, the word sweet can convey a taste of honey, or cakes having that taste, or a person with a pleasing attitude. The honey, or the cakes, or the attitude themselves have relevance for human beings. If they were not related to the same word, they would be related to different words. If they were not related to any words as their names, they could nevertheless be related to sentences composed of words to which some of their aspects are related. The fact that things are related to a word implies that they or things like them have been used to satisfy the needs of the many. They have a certain amount of generality. It's not just the words themselves that are general, but the things that are related to them through human use. The fact that there is a word for that kind of thing expresses the generality of those things, not just of the word. In fact, the word by itself is nothing. It is dependent on the relation of things to it. Meaning is the top-down word-based term for the relation between things and words. This relation is established by human beings in an ongoing way for each other, collectively and individually. We usually believe only in a word-to-thing relation, but it is the thing-to-thing and the thing-to-word relation that gives value to words for human beings. Without it, words would not have any utility for us. We have projected these linguistic processes into the organization of the collective, economically, politically, and in the structure of the family. The projections confirm and reward some types of behavior and discount others, training us, influencing our identities. They make up the context in which we live, imposing the parameters of the reality in which our self-made artificial identities operate, which we call patriarchy. Not only do women in the U.S. take the names of our husbands, but in traditional roles here and elsewhere, men take our place in the public sphere, speak for us, and often make decisions for us. We are known by who it is we are in relation to. In order to know about the relation between things and words, we need to start with things. Just as, in order to know about the relation between women and men, we have learned in feminism that we need to start with women. Men have reasoned from words to things for centuries, just as they have reasoned starting with themselves when trying to understand women and children and things. It seems to me that those who are looking for the meaning of life are, like those who are looking for the meaning of words, starting from a top-down, word-based approach. Instead, we all need to start with material gift-giving rather than linguistic, substitute, representational gift-giving. We need to be giving things, not words, satisfying material needs of others, to create abundance and the satisfaction of the material needs of all, communicating to form the physical subjectivities, the bodies, not just the linguistic or psychological subjectivities of the community. We need to create the systemic changes that will make generalized material communication possible for everyone at all levels. And I've been reading from Forgiving, A Feminist Critique of Exchange by Genevieve Vaughn, originally published in 1997. You can download this entire book online and find out more about the gift economy at gift-economy.com. And I'd like to thank Global Public Media at globalpublicmedia.com for making available the material by Richard Heinberg and Tom Greco used in this week's program. And you can download a copy of this and all previous episodes of Unwelcome Guests at unwelcomeguests.org. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Thank you for your attention.
They'll catch me napping one day and they'll kill me. Then I'll be gone, but that won't be my end. For my guns and my saddle will always be filled by